10 o'clock on Wednesday morning.
Good morning.
And it's a nice sunny day, so there we go.
Oh, that's good. Carl, have you joined us yet? Okay, well, we're still waiting for the speaker. As I was mentioning earlier, this should be a very interesting call. The Benninghausen Therapeutic Pocketbook Repertory is, until recently, something that a lot of homeopaths are not even aware of. But yet it plays a very important role in the history of homeopathy and essentially was the very first of the philosophical repertories. And we're very fortunate to have Dr. Robinson join us for the call because he's done quite a bit of study and research.
Hello.
Yeah, Carl, are you on?
I've been trying to get on for 10 minutes.
Oh, you have? Okay, well, I'm glad you made it. We have a number of people on, and we've just been casually talking among ourselves. But let's go ahead and get started. I'm going to – people don't – you don't need to mute yourselves out. I have the ability to mute everyone out. So I'm going to go ahead and just let you all know that we're going to conduct this call the way we normally do, which is I will mute everyone out of the teleconference call line, and I will conduct a formal interview for about 45 minutes. And then I'll open it up, and if people have questions they'd like to ask Dr. Robinson, they can do so at that time. So let me go ahead and mute everyone out. And Carl, can you still hear me?
Yeah.
Great. Well, first of all, I want to thank you so much for taking the time out of your busy schedule to join us. I know that everyone's going to really be able to benefit from all of the work you've done with the Therapeutic Pocketbook Repertory. So let me introduce you for those people on the call who are not familiar with you and your work. Dr. Robinson is a graduate of Yale University, where he majored in English literature. He also taught school in Nigeria between 1960 and 1962, and then in 1972, he graduated from the Hahnemann Medical College in Philadelphia. He first studied homeopathy at the NCH Summer School under Hal Williams, and has also studied homeopathy at the London Homeopathic Hospital with Dr. Frederick Troyens, as well as really all over the world in Europe, India, Canada, Argentina. He's the past editor of the Journal of the American Institute of Homeopathy, which is now known as the American Journal of Homeopathic Medicine. He's also the founder and past president of the Texas Society of Homeopathy, and he's been very active working with Homeopathy Without Borders in Cuba for the last 5 years. More recently, he's been working in Mexico, right across the border from McAllen, Texas, in a clinic in a town called Reynosa. And he's the founder and director of the Homeopathic School of the Americas, which has courses in 3 Central American countries. He has a practice in Houston and Albuquerque, and for a 2-year period, he ran a school in Albuquerque, New Mexico. So that's, as you can see, Dr. Robinson has done quite a bit of work in and for homeopathy. I can just tell you, as a friend of mine and somebody who I respect greatly, he is really somebody who has dedicated his life to homeopathy and has been really instrumental in its development in North America. He's really responsible for introducing the homeopathic community to many of the most famous homeopaths throughout the world, people like George Vitulkis and Rajan Sankaran. And I think one of the great things about Dr. Robinson is his willingness to always explore new avenues, new different ways of practicing homeopathy, but to explore those with a real sense of discrimination and critical reasoning. So, again, let me welcome you on, and thank you so much for taking the time out of your schedule to join us. Carl, I thought perhaps we could start, if you could just maybe share with the people on the call a little bit about the work you're doing in Central America. I think it's very exciting, and I think people should be aware of it.
Yeah, and I could put out a call for help on this one because I'm currently got 3 courses in 3 countries, Honduras, El Salvador, and Guatemala, and each course is meets once every 2 months for 4 days, 4 full days, and each is a 3-year course. So it's becoming kind of demanding to do this. So I'm down there every month now, leaving again on Saturday. And you'll be pleased to know we're using synthesis in Spanish.
Great.
And anyway, it's great fun, and there's a lot of interest down there. There's far more interest than there is, in my opinion, in North America in this particular time of our history. For example, in El Salvador, I have 10 MDs and 10 naturopaths. I had a school here. It had one MD in it. The rest were massage therapists. Nothing against massage therapists, but just gives you an idea of how difficult it is to attract MDs in this country into the study of homeopathy. And similarly, in Guatemala, we have a lot of MDs and even more naturopaths. So there's a total of 50 there. So it's really quite encouraging.
That's fantastic.
If anybody on the line speaks Spanish and is interested in maybe coming down there.
Later on, when I unmute, maybe some people who've heard what Dr. Robinson has just asked for, maybe they can speak up at that time. Carl, when I first suggested that you come and join us for one of these teleconference calls, you had written to us and suggested that you use the Benninghausen repertory as the point of discussion for the call. And I know you've really done a lot of work in many different areas in homeopathy. I'm curious, how did you get interested in specifically in the Benninghausen repertory?
Well, it was some sort of fluke accident. I was on the phone with Greg up at Minimum Price about 3 years ago. Said, what are some interesting new books? And he mentioned the Benninghausen repertory, which is a reformat of the therapeutic pocketbook brought out by George Dimitriadis. So he sent me a copy, and I fiddled around with it for a while and couldn't make too much heads or tails of it, and then got in touch with George by Internet finally a few months later, started corresponding, and then I just sort of read it and read it and reread it and reread it, and then I started using it. And finally I went over there and spent most of a week doing a two-day with him and just hanging out with him. And, you know, really got the confidence level up with it, and then have used almost nothing but that until recently. I'm sort of using a lot more. I'm actually into provings these days, so, sort of going straight to the source. My interest is in materia medica pura, chronic diseases, those remedies, in the provings there, and also works like Allen's Encyclopedia, Herring's Guiding Symptoms. I just find it far more interesting dealing directly with provings than with other homeopath ideas about how a remedy is supposed to act or does act. I don't know how you feel about that, Kim.
Well, yeah, I mean, I agree. And I've always, and especially with the particular books that you mentioned, and especially with the titles like Materia Medica Pura, you know, you frequently will read the symptoms from those provings and hear the patient express that symptom exactly in the same way that it's written there. And I've always found that to be a really fascinating phenomenon. I mean, I don't know how to explain
also, when you're reading some of these, just say the mental symptoms, for example, you understand that the way the provings came out in hyoscyamus, for example, is not exactly the way it's usually taught to students by people who've been passing down various ideas about hyoscyamus for decades. And it's really quite an eye-opener to read the original stuff and see, you know, what interesting symptoms were produced in those provings.
Yeah, I couldn't agree more. Now, with regard to the Benninghausen repertory, you know, this is fairly new here in North America. I know in Germany they've been really using it for a much more extended period of time, but here in North America the discussion and really use of the therapeutic pocketbook is quite a bit more limited. Could you just, for the people on the call, kind of give a differentiation between, you know, the Benninghausen repertories and the Kentine repertory, specifically the therapeutic pocketbook and the Kentine type repertories?
Sure. Really, we can say that Benninghausen, this was his third repertory. And in this one, he deconstructed symptoms is the only way to really put it, so that a proving symptom, which might have a sensation and a modality and a location, would be deconstructed into the location, the sensation, and the modality, and therefore that medicine would end up in three separate sections of his repertory. So this is not what Kent did, although Kent kind of did it. Kent would divided the book into all these parts of the body, and then under each part of the body, he would put various symptoms with the modalities and things like that. So, though Kent's deconstructed in part, he didn't deconstruct to the full extent that Boninghausen did. Boninghausen totally abstracted. By abstract, we mean that he took the symptom and lifted it out of its context, and then placed it under the appropriate heading or rubric. And this is also what Kent did, but it was done more radically. So that the idea is that once it's abstracted like that, it's pulled away from its context, and this has there's a great danger in this, because for example, if you have grief or anger or something, and many, many remedies under it, as everyone knows, each remedy tends to express or act out there or feel their grief or their anger in a different way. So even in the Kent, and all the Kent remedies, repertories, that's true also, that everything's abstracted. So, but it's even more so in Boninghausen. So you're forced to consult with an original materia medica, almost. I mean, you could just use what comes up, but it's better that you go and check it out in the materia medica. Now, that's what everybody's been saying for years. You know, you're supposed to use the repertory as a tool only and confirm by reading the materia medica. But fortunately or unfortunately, I think it's unfortunately, most people that I know, most homeopaths that I know, don't spend a lot of time reading the original provings. And rather, we have a lot of well-known teachers, and I laud them all, giving their slant on the various medicines, or their take, which is inevitably somewhat one-sided compared to the provings themselves. And I think this has been a tendency to. It's easy to see why that happens if someone is charismatic and is articulate and has had a few good cases to put forth their point of view. I think that's what all the writers of materia medica have done. I call them the secondary materia medicas, like the Boricke, the Fatak, the Kent, and on, people who've written their own materia medicas are all giving their ideas, more or less, rather than anchoring it back to the original data. How do you think about that, Kim?
Well, yeah, I mean, I agree. I think that sometimes there is genuine information derived from clinical practice which does get added in materia medicas, but I also agree that a lot of it obviously is speculation, and I think that there's, as you mentioned earlier, there's a lot of myths that have crept into our materia medica, and
yeah.
When you go back to the original provings, you see that what you think is true about a remedy isn't necessarily the case. So, yeah, I agree with you 100% about that.
Well, I want to reinforce what you just said, because there is a lot of clinical data that comes in, and one of the most interesting to me is anacardium. Anacardium is, in the repertories, is full of such things as antagonism with himself, feeling of separated, devil on one shoulder, angel on the other,
sure.
Sensation of two wills and all that. Very interesting, if you read in chronic diseases, the proving, there's not a word of that. But if you read Hahnemann's brief introduction to the proving, which was presumably written sometime after the original proving, he adds in that they have a lack of moral sense. I'm reading right now. And he writes, a condition as if he had two wills, of which the one annuls what the other impels him to do. So it's very interesting that presumably Hahnemann, in the basis of a long use of the medicine anacardium, found out that this was true clinically and sort of appended it into the introduction.
It's very interesting. I mean, I don't think we can overvalue the importance of going back to those original provings and really reading them and understanding homeopathy from that base and then, you know, proceeding from there. I think it's just essential. You know, getting back to the Benninghausen repertory, you know, a lot of people not being familiar with it, they're not sure that they, you know, they don't feel confident using it in their practice. And I actually had an experience that actually gave me a level of a degree of confidence about this repertory. When I was in Bombay, India, there was a malarial outbreak, and I was with Dr. Farooq Master, and he said, we have to go and treat the people in this part of Bombay where this outbreak is occurring. And he only grabbed one repertory from his bookshelf, and it happened to be the therapeutic pocketbook.
The, sure, it wasn't the Boger Boninghausen.
No, it wasn't the Boger Boninghausen. It was it was Demetriotis's book, actually.
Oh, really?
Yeah, and that was the only book he grabbed. And, you know, it only has 125 remedies, and you know, I thought, well, you know, is this going to be enough? He felt it was completely enough, and he went in there, and the genus epidemicus for that particular outbreak was Arsenicum, which he arrived at through that repertory, and basically everyone was effectively treated with Arsenicum. And it was really an amazing experience for me to see. So I'm curious, how did you develop confidence about this repertory? I mean, that's why I have it, but I'm curious, have you had some experience like this where you've seen its efficacy?
Well, yeah, I've had a lot of experience. I just started using it and began to find that it was working. Now, you want me to go over a case or something, maybe? Or?
Yeah, sure. Yeah, feel free to do whatever you think would be useful to
all right.
The people on the call.
Just to give an idea, I had a 55-year-old man who I treated quite successfully with ferrum metallicum some years ago, and about 2 years after that, he came in with inflammation of the scrotum and the inguinal areas and the ventral surface of the proximal penis and part of the upper medial thighs, that whole area. And looking at it, it was very red, very inflamed, and he said it burned, and occasionally it was uncontrollable itching. Now, the lesion worsened during sweating and was considerably better with air circulating around. So as a result, he didn't wear underpants, and he often wore nothing but a terry cloth robe while he was indoors. So using the Boninghausen repertory, that the lesion worsened wearing underwear and was sweating, I took just three things into account. The location, male genitalia, that's one rubric. And then the modality, worse, by becoming wet from perspiration. And the third modality, the second modality, worse from the pressure of clothing. And sepia came out in all three, grade three, out of a possible four grades. So he received sepia 30 in water, 5 drops once daily, and within 2 days there was significant improvement, and it continued. Within a few weeks it cleared completely. Now, I then, you know, even though I'm talking about going to the Materia Medica to confirm, a careful reading of sepia and chronic diseases does not yield this exact skin lesion. But the combination of the location and two modalities clearly pointed to sepia. Now, there were no mental symptoms, and there were no generals that I could take into account. Now, what I wish to make a point of here is that this is more or less the inductive method in a rather pure sense. You're just taking the cardinal symptoms and letting them lead you where they lead. And that's sepia came out. Now, the reason it's interesting is because, again, unfortunately or fortunately, I think unfortunately, the way sepia is taught is that it's always gender skewed. And with, you know, they're saying 90% of all people would need sepia are women, and then all this and that about better for motion, worse at rest, on and on. All these things about how a sepia patient is supposed to look and supposed to behave and supposed to have, you know, female hormonal problems. So in that sense, using this in a very clean sort of way, sepia popped out and did nice work. And the most strange symptom there was the worse from the perspiration, which is also in synthesis. But the beauty in the Boninghausen is that there's fewer symptoms always.
Sure.
So now let me let's see what else.
Well, I remember that Asafoetida case that I had presented when I was at your school, and I hadn't even tried to work it out with the TBR, the Boninghausen Repertory, but I remember you worked it out and it came out to the same remedy, and I thought that was quite amazing. Do you remember that?
Yeah.
That was very interesting.
This fellow, George Dimitriadis, he's a very bright guy.
Oh, yeah.
He's a very, very bright guy, a very careful guy, and he's probably the first... I think I can say it. He is the first writer on homeopathy since Hahnemann. He uses as many or more footnotes than Hahnemann himself.
Sure.
I've never seen anything like it. He's got a new book out, and I mean, sometimes the he'll write a chapter, and then the footnotes will occupy more pages than the chapter. It's called Homeopathic Diagnosis, Hahnemann through Boninghausen. Very dense book, but full of good stuff. And
yeah, I've heard it's excellent. I don't know if you know Joe Kellerstein, but he was raving about it and saying,
"Oh, good,
good. Excellent work." I haven't gotten a copy myself, but I'm excited to see it.
Some other things that I emphasize when I teach, I'm trying to teach, you know, fairly pure stuff coming out of Hahnemann and people like Boninghausen. And Boninghausen, I think, understood Hahnemann well enough so that he was able to, let's say, make it maybe more clear even than Hahnemann himself. And Boninghausen came up with the idea that of a complete symptom. And a complete symptom usually has three elements, which is the complaint itself. And the complaint itself is usually subdivided into a sensation, an unpleasant sensation, or a description, such as an ulcer or skin thing. So that's the complaint. And then there's the location. And finally, there's the modalities. And with those three, you can usually make a complete symptom, or you can certainly make a try at it. And then a fourth possible one is the idea of a concomitant. And this is kind of the way I do it, basing it, trying to make every symptom as complete as possible, and then looking for concomitant problems, and each concomitant problem also fleshing that out into as complete a symptom as possible.
Sure.
Which is, I think, what everyone does, but... I guess I'm systematizing it more now in my teaching.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's an excellent approach. I know one of the criticisms that I hear frequently is that the Boninghausen repertory doesn't have a sufficient number of remedies. Do you have any comments about that? About the I mean, for example, I know that Calibichromicum and Gelsimium, for example, are not in that repertory.
Right. Yeah.
Do you have any comments on that,
sure, I have comments on that. I mean, I agree that it could be. I'm sure, you know, at Boninghausen, were he to come around again, would update it significantly. And I don't think he would at all be against extra medicines. I'm certainly not against extra medicines. On the other hand, I know the thing that Dimitriadis keeps repeating is that he says at least you can rely on these 130.
Right.
These medicines completely. He feels that they're totally reliable, what's in there.
Right.
On the other hand, in the Boninghausen repertory, if you look under desire, salt, natrum muriaticum isn't there. Well, probably for a very good reason. If you look into the original proving, it's not there. But obviously, through clinical experience, it came to be a very important part, and that's why clinical experience is important. And actually... clinical experience must have played a huge role in the creation of this repertory by Boninghausen, because he's the one that assigned all these grades, 1 through 4.
Right.
And he apparently had the largest and busiest and one of the most successful, perhaps the most successful practice in Europe toward the end of his life after Hahnemann passed on. He was number one guy.
Sure.
I don't know if the listeners know this, but he was not trained as a medical doctor. He was trained as a botanist and as a lawyer.
Mm.
So that's quite a combination.
Yeah, yeah.
So with a lawyer, with the botanist thing, you learn how to classify all the taxonomy of plants and all that, and the lawyer how to make a cogent, you know, reasoning. So he was a brilliant guy, and the way he got into it was that he had consumption, I guess. That was the
right
name for tuberculosis. And he wrote
right
to a friend of his who was a new convert to Hahnemann. And the guy wrote back and said, send me your symptoms. He did. The guy prescribed, I think it was pulsatilla.
Pulsatilla, yep.
And he recovered rather quickly and completely, and he was so bowled over by it that he started studying it. But, you know, the very fact that he could have recovered with pulsatilla, I mean, that's not the kind of thing anyone would think of today. And to get back to that idea is that a lot of these provings that Hahnemann and others did have not just hundreds, but often 2,000 or more symptoms. Now, when you, and they're certainly not all in any repertory, but when you start taking, say you take 120, 130 medicines, and you work out the mathematics for what you can come up with when you combine them in different ways, and you're getting billions and billions of possibilities. So that suggests that by recombining these deconstructed symptoms, these medicines can cover a lot more than we think they can. So presumably these medicines that are in there can cover a huge amount of pathology.
Carl, in the Benninghausen repertory, there's a large number of remedies that are listed under anatomical locations. Can you give a little bit of explanation about what that's all about?
Well, again, the book starts out with regional symptomata, which is head, external head, internal head, eyes, vision, ears, hearing, nose, olfaction, face, mouth, then the trunk, neck, chest, abdomen, internal, external, back, upper extremities, lower extremities. Then it goes into systems, the alimentary system, the urinary system, the reproductive system, the respiratory system, the cardiovascular system, and the thermoregulatory system, including all kinds of fevers and chills. And presumably, through his experience, he found that, and it's clear, I think, from any repertory he used, that certain medicines favor or affect certain parts of the body anatomically more than other parts. So that's how he did it. But if you look up under these things, you just get remedies. You don't get remedies with much. So occasionally there's something. But when you get to his section on compound fevers, which is probably far superior to what's in the Kent repertory. They don't seem to correspond very well, which is very interesting to me. But that's very useful. Of course, today, with everybody taking Tylenol and stuff and suppressing fevers, you never get a chance to see the order. You know, the order is, it could be fever first, then chill, then perspiration, or it could be any combination of that. You could have chill with perspiration or without perspiration, then heat, and blah, blah, blah. It goes on and on. You can form many, many combinations. Unfortunately, that's not seen anymore. Probably Farouk Master took that into account when he was looking at those malaria cases. I'm almost certain he must have. At any rate, then, are you still there?
Yeah, well, I'm here. I'm listening.
Okay.
Yeah.
Then he goes into the mind. He has the mind section. Now, this is probably the hardest part for a modern homeopath to deal with, because there's only 2 pages of symptoms, and they're highly, highly, highly abstracted. And they're so abstracted that there's just these very general states like anxiety, apprehensiveness, cheerfulness, haughtiness, hopelessness, so on. And then when you get to the end of the book, the modalities, it'll have another couple of pages on mental symptoms worse from various things. But when I'm talking about abstraction, it's so unlike the Kent thing that it seems just too brief. Let me give you an example. When you come to the huge general modality section at the end of the book, they have the time section. It just says worse in the morning, worse in the forenoon, worse in the afternoon, worse in the evening, worse in the night, worse before midnight, and then worse after midnight. Now, when you think about how Kent and all people after him, you know, favored the exact hour of the night, this is a huge change, you know, because, well, it's obvious that if you don't have to worry about whether it occurred at 1, 2, or 3, or 4, or 5 in the morning, it makes it a lot simpler. And then you can consult with the materia medica to sort out if the time is more important, you see?
Right, right.
That's highly, highly abstracted.
Mm.
And so on and so forth throughout the thing. His categories are highly abstracted. That is, they're condensed into, and it's very, very brief. So you have to be very, that's another thing, you have to be very, very careful about which rubric you select. So, again, you have to have an eye for what's strange and what's, you know.
So, Carl, if you have a case in front of you where, you know, maybe it's a one-sided mental case and there's really, you know, no good physical symptoms, or even if there are, they're very general and there's no modalities and maybe no concomitants and everything seems very vague, that he can't describe the sensation and it's mostly a mental case. Will you still rely on the Benninghausen repertory, or will you
go to synthesis? Yeah, I mean, you can, or you could use synthesis or the complete or something else. But why don't I read a case from Dimitriadis?
Okay, yeah.
This is the title is Aggressive Psychosis. It's a 14-year-old girl who presented with severe emotional disorder, which seemed to date back to her having been, quote, bashed, unquote, 12 months earlier. Also coincided with her menarche and relationship breakup. Symptoms have become worse over the past 6 weeks or so, and no menses since 2 months. Becomes depressed, angry, suicidal, feels as if crazy, talks aloud to herself and hears voices, becomes threatening with lots of foul language, parenthesis, fuck, cunt, shit, close parenthesis, and very aggressive, striking out in anger, wants to hurt people and break things, not scared of anyone anymore, certainly not of any authority. The girl was now feared by her friends at school, and the parents were at a loss to know what to do. And psychiatry had not improved things. So Dimitriadis took three rubrics, all from the mental. He took malicious, audacious, and insanity.
Let me repeat that again. Malicious, audacious, and insanity.
Yeah.
Okay.
Just those three.
Okay.
And Veratrum album came up, and then he went to Materia Medica Pura. And he then included in the book about 10 or 12 symptoms from Materia Medica Pura. I'll read them. Along with persistent fury, great heat of the body. Fury tears his clothes and does not speak. He bites his shoe to pieces and swallows the fragments. Mania, he alleges he is a hunter. He pretends he is a prince and gives himself airs accordingly. She kisses everyone who comes near before the occurrence of the menses. He does not talk unless excited to do so. Then he scolds. Cannot bear to be talked to. Crossness when cause is given. He gets very cross. Every trifle excites him. He searches for faults in others and taunts them. At any rate, he put her on Veratrum 30 daily in water, and the girl started moving right ahead within a week or so, and then within 3 months was completely normal. So there's an example of a pretty wild case. But, I mean, clearly he went back to Materia Medica.
Was Veratrum the only remedy that came up with those three rubrics? There must have been others as well.
There must have been others. I don't have that because I didn't plug it in myself.
Mm-hmm. But that's very interesting. I mean,
yeah. So, I mean, it's certainly possible that I had a mental case where lycopodium came out and it worked nicely using just the so, but you have to be very, you know, you have to be really quite astute. You can't, well, but it's the same problem with the other repertoires. If you're using a synthesis, you have
It is, you're right.
Your great danger is you're going to select a tiny rubric and miss the remedy.
Sure.
Which doesn't have, it might be a perfect rubric, but it doesn't happen to include your remedy.
Sure, sure.
So that's the other side of it.
Sure.
So,
yeah, I think that's why they you know, it's so common to see people when they use Kantian repertoires combining rubrics because, you know, if you don't, you run into exactly that problem. You know?
Yeah.
You had mentioned earlier, Carl, about a complete symptom having the, you know, the location, the cessation, the concomitant, and the modality of the case. What about a complete case? Can you tell us a little bit about that?
Yeah, sure. Let me just read to you the hexameter of Boninghausen.
Sure.
Now, Boninghausen, in the course of his reading, found some verses dating back from the beginning of the 12th century. And these verses came from theologic scholastics. I guess they were monks. And these monks used this hexameter. Hexameter here refers to apparently the way it was written, the kind of beat and stuff like that, because there's hexameter means six, but there's seven elements, so it must have had to do with the verse. But at any rate, there's seven elements.
I've always wondered about that, Carl, why those numbers didn't match up.
Yeah, I think it's because it was a poetic form. And the verse is, quis quid ubi quibus auxilius cur quomodo quando. And the monks used it to judge moral lapses in their brethren. So it was used to sort of get all the evidence together. At any rate, these seven elements in English, quis is who, quid is what, ubi is where, quibus auxilius is concomitant, cur is why, quomodo is modalities, and quando is when. Now, the idea is that if you take who, you're to include the sex, the age, the bodily constitution, the temperament, the personality, the individuality, the nature. And in Boninghausen's lesser writings, he states clearly that the greatest and most important variations are here found mostly in the states of mind and spirit. He was very much, along with Hahnemann, emphasizing the mental state. He thought it was sine qua non for a successful prescription in many cases. Not all, but in many. So that's who. Then you take what, and what refers to the complaints themselves, the disease, its nature, the peculiarity of the disease, the need for pure observation, the need for diagnosis, and the use and limitations of diagnosis. Then when you get to ubi or where, that's location. And which side of the body, where in the body, things like that. Sometimes the location is itself peculiar, particularly if you have mostly right-sided, mostly left-sided, or if you have perspiration mostly just on certain parts of the body, only the head, only the ventral side, or something like that. Very interestingly, Boninghausen comments that ulcers on the dorsal side of the fingers and toes is a good example of location. And the dorsal side is the, if your palm is down, it's the upside, it's the top of your palm, of your hand. So ulcers on the dorsal side of the fingers and toes is sepia, and he comments that everybody knows that. It's like, you know, I never heard anybody ever mention that. So it's one of those things that sort of passed out of the common pool of knowledge, but there's an example of where location is very important. Another thing, well, that reminds me that the Bunninghausen Repertory devotes an undue, it seems like an unduly large area to skin problems. And I believe that skin problems were not as well controlled back 150 years ago. I'm almost certain of that. I think probably it was a hygiene thing in part, and plus they didn't know how to suppress them. I don't know, but it's interesting that it's really a large section. And the fourth of this hexameter is quibus auxilius, or concomitant. And these are the symptoms accompanying the main complaints. And they have to be, a true concomitant has to be understood as a problem which is connected and it's unusual. In other words, if you had hay fever and with nose blocked up and running and watery eyes, you could say watery eyes was a concomitant to the nasal problems, but that's not really, that's not really what's meant by the idea of a concomitant.
That's a very good point, Carl. Yeah.
It's got to be a concomitant from another sphere of the body. So, for example, Kali bichromium is known for sinus problems, and it's also known for ulcers in the stomach, and it's also known for sciatic pains and small points in the, which can be covered in small points in the low back and buttock. So that would be a proper concomitant. So then we get to number five, cur or why, and that's causation. Causation, of course, can be trauma, toxic exposure, drugs, and then emotional, all kinds of emotional things, or never well since the disease, and miasmatic things. And many times the illness will turn on that. I mean, that becomes indispensable. Quomodo or modalities, we've mentioned that, and that's probably to make a complete symptom. That's probably the most useful one of all. But sometimes it's location and sometimes it's sensation. Then we get to quando or when, and that could mean the time when the thing began in the life of the patient. It also could mean the time of aggravation in the 24 hours, and also the sequence of events. Because in the sequence you can sometimes figure out sort of layers of the case. So those seven elements, it's interesting because they're really not very different from what detectives use to solve crimes. So this is really suggests that we're in the company of people who use induction to solve problems. And if you have all these seven things, you've got a complete case. Would you agree?
No, completely, yeah. Do you find that usually you'll get all these things in your cases?
No.
Yeah, it's hard, isn't it?
But it depends. If it's a complicated case, yeah, there tends to be most of them, sometimes all of them.
Sure. Now, Carl, I don't know if you've done much work with the Bossier-Bedinghausen characteristic
repertory. No, I haven't. I'm curious to get into that, but I haven't gotten into it. You done it?
Well, yeah, actually, I was I had the opportunity to sit in on a class recently at the National Center of Homeopathy Summer School Conference where Lucas Shepard gave a weekend seminar on it, and I found it very interesting. I mean, the approach is fairly similar. I think the biggest difference is that you've got a lot of local modalities after the symptoms, whereas in the Bedinghausen therapeutic pocketbook repertory, everything's been generalized to a much greater extent.
It's a much bigger book. Here.
Yes, it's a bigger book. There's more remedies as well and more rubrics also because of the fact that all the modalities have not been generalized. You've got local modalities.
Right.
There. Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah, I think it's probably a very useful book. Have you used it at all?
Well, I had never actually used it in my practice. I found it very easy to learn. For me, I'd always been familiar with a therapeutic pocketbook, but I think it's definitely a repertory worth exploring, and I think certainly in some cases, as always, it's always the most important thing is the patient's health. So whatever tool we have available that can help in any particular case, it's worth looking into,
I wanted to add that I finally got involved in doing a proving down in Guatemala and Honduras in the last month.
Oh, can you tell us a little bit about that?
Yeah, I got a hold of a book by Edmund Carleton, old surgeon in America about 100 years ago. You know the book?
No. What's it called?
I don't know. His name is Carlton, I think.
Mm-hmm.
Anyway, he mentioned that he cured some cases of Dupuytren's contracture, which is where the tendons in the hand form a claw due to contractions, that he cured with plantago. So I was curious, so I looked up plantago and Allen. It's not in the Hahnemann didn't prove it. And very interesting remedy. Didn't say anything about this kind of thing, however. But it turned out to have many, many symptoms concerning all areas of the body, and I thought this could be a polycrest. So we gave it out in Guatemala, and now I did this all the wrong way because I'm not schooled in how to do a proving. I just, you know, nobody signed a release. They just all took it. And then the next day they started talking, and the day after they talked, and that was it. It only lasted 2 days. So it was, you know, not the way it's supposed to be done. Nobody took a history. They knew I'd lectured on it, so they knew the remedy they were taking.
Uh-huh.
They heard a lecture. Interesting thing was it didn't make any difference.
Uh-huh.
They came up with all kinds of symptoms,
huh,
which they could not have come up with based on the lecture because I didn't say any of those things.
Mm.
But, for example, like two women said that they had a pain in the right shoulder, which extended into the right upper arm. It felt like a bruise sensation. And the next day, two other women stood up and said they had it in the same pain in the left shoulder extending into the left upper arm, also the same sensation. You know, out of a group of, say, 25 people that took it, that's pretty amazing. And I was, like, astounded.
It really is astounding. When you see a proving like that, I've seen that same thing, Carl. It is an amazing thing to experience.
It changes your idea. This is the, in other words, you think, hey, these remedies really do something.
Yeah.
You know,
I was at Dr. Paul Hirschke's class when they were involved in approving of belladonna, and he told me what the remedy was. Nobody in the room knew it, and every single person stood up and basically read from a piece of paper that they had written about their symptoms, and every person was describing right-sided, throbbing headaches with feelings of flushness to the face, and it was unbelievable, really, to hear it one after
really?
Another. They were describing belladonna as I knew the remedy.
Is that unbelievable?
Yeah.
That's nice to hear, because this remedy had a lot of orbital around the eye, the orbit pain, sharp pains, and a lot of people had that. But one woman stood up the next day crying and said she developed this terrible sense of emptiness in the stomach with terrible, terrible sadness. And then she just couldn't continue, and so we sat her down and antidoted her. The next day, there's a concomitant.
Yeah.
Emptiness in the stomach with extreme sadness, you know. So the next day she said, well, after being antidoted, all the mental stuff went away. But then within 3 hours, she developed this extreme pain in the anus, which felt like a prolapse. She didn't use the word prolapse. But it was unbearable, and the only possible relief she could get was making a fist out of her hand and putting it and lying down, face down, with her hand right about where the bladder is, and that gave her some relief. Pretty interesting modality. And again, and I don't know anywhere in the literature if there's anything involving the anus. It's all the rectum, you know. So
fascinating.
Went on and on. There was just many, many, many interesting symptoms.
Mm-hmm. That's fascinating.
So I was. I'm going to probably do a proving now every 8 weeks.
Oh, fantastic!
All
Carl,
over
that's great.
And I want to find out some things. Like I want to do plumbum, for example. Mm-hmm. I read Plumbum and Allen, 120 pages of provings. They're mostly, I guess, toxicity. And they're talking about the worst kind of mania, the worst kind of insanity.
Sure.
And they had to put these people in straitjackets. They mentioned straitjackets many times.
Mm.
You look up in Kent, and all the symptoms and Plumbum, almost all of them are grade one. Now, what's going on?
Yeah, interesting.
How does this happen? Grade one, when you're talking about this kind of insanity, and also the pains are so terrible that people are screaming in pain. I mean, pains that are just beyond the beyond, things that none of us see, really. And they're all in grade one with Kent. So something's got to be.
A lot of food for thought there, that's for sure.
Yeah.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, you know, this has been really a fascinating interview for me. I mean, I think just you touched on so many really interesting points.
I'm going to go ahead and unmute the line so that we can let the audience, the people on the call, ask you some questions as well.
Sure.
I did want to mention, since you're talking about the Benninghausen repertory quite a bit, that there's two very good contemporary translations of the therapeutic pocketbook, which was originally printed in 1846. There's the one by George Dimitriadis, which is in printed form, and there's also one that was done by Peter Vint. He's a Hanumanian scholar in Germany, which is available in the Radar program. And I also believe that George Dimitriadis and his group also have a software program that incorporates their translation of the Benninghausen
repertory.
Yeah,
I've got that. Yeah.
So is that correct?
Yeah, I use that, yeah.
That you use that. Okay, great. All right, so let me go ahead and unmute it, and thank you again so much.
You're welcome.
I thoroughly enjoyed it, and I'll say goodbye just a little bit after we've had let other people ask some questions. So
okay.
Hold on. Okay, anybody have any questions they'd like to ask?
I've got one, Carl. This is Andy Hendrickson in California. How are you?
Hi, Andy.
Good.
Good God, how are you?
Good.
Great to hear your voice.
Thanks, it's great to hear yours. And nice presentation, thank you.
Welcome.
I was just curious what your feeling is about the repertorium universal. Obviously, one idea is, based on what you said, that the 125 remedies in the TPB are really reliable because of where they came from. And with mixing all these other sources in the biggest compilation repertory ever made, it's going to reduce the reliability as well as, you know, make a huge data set that you have to work with instead of a smaller one.
What's it called? I don't even know the name of it. What's it called?
Oh, it's basically the complete repertory taken to the next level, where he took all Benninghausen's symptoms and Benninghausen-type symptoms from elsewhere, and correct me if I'm wrong, Kim, and created a way that you can use the Benninghausen method except with many more remedies, obviously, involved. I mean, basically the whole Materia Medica as we know of it now, with all the general
yes.
symptoms and locations and so on. I don't know how much deconstructing he did, but
let me comment a little bit on that.
Okay.
The problem as you get more and more data is that it becomes more and more confusing, especially when you're beginning. One of the nice things about the program that Kim has done is that they've, you know, you can push a key and reduce the size of the repertory. Now, that's really kind of useful because you may be the kind of homeopath who doesn't want all that extra data, or you may be the kind of person who does, so you have a choice. You know, it's very, very difficult to know. You know, on the surface, it seems like more information is better, but it's got to be good information, and how do you know if you can trust it? It's sort of a can of worms, don't you think?
I think that's one of the big problems using that method with such a huge data set. Do you think that's the only problem, or how practical? I mean, I have a couple of colleagues that have used Roger Van Zandvoort's new repertory using a quasi-Benninghausen method and had some cures that they would not normally have come up with by other methods, so that was good to hear. I haven't personally bought that repertory yet. I was just curious how you think it would work with, you know, a huge gargantuan version of Benninghausen.
In a way, I'm kind of doing that. In Central America, I haven't been able to get a hold of the Benninghausen thing. It's in Spanish. I haven't been able to get a hold of it. So we're using synthesis in Spanish. But I'm really emphasizing the idea of a complete symptom, you know, the complaint itself, the description or the sensation, the location and the modalities. And with that, you can still use any repertory and be more precise, you see? And you make every symptom as complete as possible that way. So you can definitely use a larger repertory.
Okay.
All right, good. Thanks, Andy. Nice to hear your voice.
Thank you, Kim.
Other question. Does anybody else have a question?
I do. Margaret in Boston, I missed the name of the remedy for the 14-year-old girl. I just didn't understand what...
A Veratrum album.
Can people hear us?
Yes.
Get that?
Yes. Okay, so did everyone hear that was Veratrum album as the remedy? Okay, I think we have time for, let's just do two more questions because we're running out of time here, so two more.
What was the one that was used for the hand that the tendons were going into a claw?
Plantago.
Okay.
Oh, yeah, Plantago. Edmund Carlton.
Oh, Mr. Robinson, do you go down to Salvador and Guatemala and Honduras? Is that correct?
Yes, ma'am.
Oh, I have a daughter in Piscor in Salvador, and I sent her with her homeopathic kit, you know, and she's been using it in the village. Anyway, I was wondering how could if she wanted to get in touch with you, how could she do that?
Does she have email?
Yes.
Okay, I'm at Carl. That's Carl with a K. Carl Robinson at earthlink.net.
Can you just repeat that one more time, Carl, for everybody?
Carl Robinson at earthlink.net.
And it's Carl, K-A-R-L. Is that correct?
Right.
Yeah, okay, good.
R-O-B-I-N-S-O-N?
Yeah, R-O-B-I-N-S-O-N. I'm leaving Saturday for Guatemala, and then within 4 days I'll be in El Salvador. So she must write me in the next 2-3 days.
Well, I will send her your email. I'm sorry to be so dense here. Carl Robinson at Earthlink, did you say?
Yeah, .net.
.net. Well, and one other quick question. You said that there is a Bunnenhausen computer program. Those guys, Demetriadis, put one out.
Yeah,
that
you can
correct.
Download
There's
it
program.
From on the internet. And
Well, where would you go?
Well, email me. I'll see what I can do for you when I get back to Houston. I've got the address.
Oh no, I'm a fan.
Okay.
Yes. Yes.
Sure.
All right. Any other questions anybody would like to ask before we end the call? Okay. Well, Carl, thank you again so much.
Thank you.
And can everyone
much.
Just can we give Carl a big round of applause?
Really, thank you so
thank
much.
You.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Goodbye.
All right. Take care, everyone. Carl, thank you so much.
Bye. Thank you.
Bye. Bye.
Bye. Bye.
Well, thank you. Are you there, Kim?